third and final hour on this edition of the Hagman Report. And each and every Tuesday in hour number three, we are fortunate enough to be joined by Mr. Standeo. Standeo.com is the website. And there on Standeo.com, you go to the show images page on the right-hand side, just next to the microphone under the YouTube banner, and click the show images button. And that pops up what the page Stan puts together with his research, his findings, and anything else he wants to visualize. And we go over that information when he comes on with us each and every Tuesday. Stan, it's great to have you back. Oh, we don't have him yet. Sorry, Eric. I jumped.
Well, it's great to
one.
Be back, Doug and Joe.
Is that a good impression of Stan? No, it's not. I can't do impressions worth, you know, hooey.
Just like last week, Stan's going to be joining us via Skype video. And he's been on.
That's
when he comes on, he's usually on audio. And last week, for whatever reason, we had him do the video feed. And I believe that's because there was a problem with the transformer at Global Star.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And
yeah.
That he wasn't able to connect through the usual means, so now we're doing the Skype video.
Well, he always looks so good. I want him like in Indiana Jones kind of. He does look like Indiana Jones, you know, in a way. What? Oh, okay. Oh, he's on? Shh, don't tell him I said that.
Hey, Stan.
Stan.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
There we go. Now he can, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, you're the man. You're the man.
Yes, well, not Indiana Jones, but not look-alike anyway, but...
Well, you're dapper enough to be Indiana Jones, really, and I'll tell you what, you've had the experiences thereof, so... And I hear a four-legged friend in the background. Our lady, the studio dog, heard, believe it or not, I bring my dog to the studio every night. And, she heard that little tinkle of a bell, you know, or call or whatever. And her ears just perked up. I'm watching her. So anyway.
Yeah. I don't know what's happened. Someone's up at the door, I guess. They all went berserk up there. So.
Oh, well, that's...
Anyway.
All right. So it's another week, another set of headlines, another quadrant of destruction. You got fires, you got floods, you got fire and brimstone. I don't know what else we got going, but...
Famines. Venezuela today, IMF today announced Venezuela's inflation rate was going to go up 2,300%, but in 2018, leading to just terrible... economic system to where people have been fighting for scraps of food to survive, and then, you know, multiplying these people's ability not to get food, their inability to get food. They're going to multiply that with this inflation rate, and pretty soon nobody's going to be able to get any food. And one thing that's really bothering me about Venezuela is no solutions have been put forward, no remedies to fix the current trends of the economics. And these people are going to continue to suffer at a massive level if this continues to move forward without intervention in some way.
Socialism there is working, by the way.
Yeah. Equal misery for all.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you got to wonder what is going to happen. I mean, the government can't stand that kind of performance. It's just going to be revolution.
No, you're absolutely right. And is that, Stan, in your view? Is that kind of like a look into our future if things keep going the way they're going?
Yes. The Venezuelans were not, you know, as affluent as we are here in America. And that makes a big difference in the crowd reaction when resources get skinny. Now, here, people have been raised not maybe one generation and a half, where, you know, things that you eat were grown at the grocery store. You just go get them there and that's it. We've never done without as a nation. You know, there's been plenty of dairy products and vegetables and meat and everything. And, you know, nobody goes hungry as a general rule unless they're, you know, in a low income family or, you know, disadvantaged somehow or another. So when we have a revolution, if we do, but I think we will, it will be because people have suddenly realized, well, I can't go to the store and buy any food. There's none there, and if it was, I couldn't afford it anyway. That's lack of preparation, lack of foresight, because you know, people are just dazed thinking that, the government will take care of us, everything will be all right. It's been that way before, it'll be that way tomorrow. And that, I think, is going to make our reaction a lot quicker, a lot more severe than what might happen in, say, Venezuela. if they haven't been used to so much, you know, they've depended totally upon the grocery store. They've been growing their own and doing local community stuff a lot more than we have here. And this does present a real problem because people are going to start, you know, attacking each other for resources here if we have a civil war. As I say, I think we probably will.
Okay.
It'll be interesting.
That looks not too promising, but I do believe we will as well. Or the way I see it, and I think you had described this, and it wasn't recently. It was some time ago. I think we're already in a civil war. The first shots have not, or maybe they have been fired already, but the memo just hasn't really gone out that the civil war is active. You know, it's just we're divided among racial lines, among all lines,
religious lines, yeah. Financial lines. I mean, the religion side of it is certainly a major factor, but the race or culture type thing, you know, we've got Hispanics against Americans per se, that's a biggie. Black against white, black against yellow, yellow against black, I mean, all that kind of stuff. It's and conservative against a liberal. This country is firmly divided, you know, that way. That doesn't take blind faith to see that in the news. And as you say, it's an undeclared, officially type civil war because people are taking sides, just like in the 1800s in the Great Civil War that we had before.
Very interesting, Stan. And, you know, with all the stuff going on, I want to bring your attention to this, kind of bring this together. As I was talking with John after the show about this last night, it seems that the since the eclipse, and that was August 21st.
Oh, I heard you guys talking about this. Yeah.
You know, immediately after the eclipse, then we had the formation and then devastation of Hurricane Harvey, then Irma. Then you have, you know, these earthquakes that are seeming to increase in different parts across the country and the world. And then from Mexico City, the 7.4 or whatever it was down there. Then you have, you know, the Las Vegas and now wildfires. People were, I've read a lot of different things on the internet that say that all this chaos, you know, jumping from one news story to the other of chaos, whether it's natural disasters, you know, terrorist attacks, you know, wildfires, that it's just been this ongoing roller coaster since the eclipse. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, Stan, because I know in ancient cultures, many cultures would look at the eclipse as a harbinger of doom. Many people, I mean, there was lots of different cultures that practiced lots of different things when the eclipse was taking place. But I want to ask you, if you think there's anything to that, or it was just the eclipse happened and it's a coincidence that it fell at that time. And then all this other stuff that we're seeing is, you know, just as a matter of coincidence after the fact. Or do you think there's a relation?
I do think that we've seen an increase in natural disasters, a significant one since, well, late August. September 23rd even was a symbol for the sign of the times. If you look at the Revelation 12 passage about the Virgo and the Leo constellation, these things mark the season and the lunar or solar eclipse that occurred over the United States may have been particularly for us to see, to realize that we're going to be in judgment. Certainly we've, as a country, we've fallen way short of the mark of what we should be as witnesses for the good Lord. But with that being said, I think this will continue to escalate these problems, these disasters, right on into the tribulation period. I think we're at the doorstep of that. Certainly you have the hurricanes, the earthquakes are triggered also by solar gravitational and lunar gravitational variations, especially when our planet is, I think, starting to expand just slightly, taking on more energy from the sun, because it can take on energy in through the north and south pole and through the electric field from the solar wind. We have an unusual solar minimum this time, solar sunspot minimum, in that we're seeing potential threats to the planet of solar EMP flares about every 30 days at the present development on the surface of the sun. we should see another pass at us, which could potentially produce an EMP event here around the first week of November, last week of October. I forget exactly what the date is, but it's every 28 days. And so it'll probably be around the last week of October on the 30th that we'll see the Earth-facing side of the sun come with, you know, potential halo, that, you know, circular type, EMP type CMEs produced by the sun coming straight at the Earth. The EMP produced by the sun is not as bad as EMPs produced by a nuclear detonation. It's a slower, more lethargic type EMP and hits more our power grid than it does homes and cars, or, you know, electronics. Not all cars are going to be affected by it anyway. As I said last week, the current research shows that the great majority of cars will just simply turn off, even in a nuclear EMP, and you just turn the key and start them again and drive off. Anyway, that all these things, I think, that are quote-unquote natural disasters, I think, are going to be later determined to be judgments of God, you know, in the historical look at this time period.
And Stan, I've never seen. I don't mean to take you off your stride, but where you're getting some comments, your video looks great. The audio, there's something going on. We can hear what you're saying perfectly fine. Yeah, there it is. It's like some electronic interference. It makes this loud humming sound.
Well, hold on. Let me see.
Wow, there you go.
That's better. Whatever you did, the volume, your volume is better, which.
Yeah, you just knocked it out of the park there.
Is it okay now?
Yeah.
Yeah, perfect.
Maybe it was just moving the earpiece. I'm not sure. It sounded either like electronic interference or something like that.
Go figure. Well,
Holly says I have magic fingers. Sometimes my lamp here or the power, supply down here does interfere.
Well, it sounds better than it did 20 seconds ago, so.
Okay, sorry about that. Well, there you go.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm sitting here looking at the earthquake map because things are happening as we speak. I'm watching earthquakes in Central America, Mexico. I did a study, which I haven't put up on the show images page today, of earthquakes, you know, over the last, 18 months, 14 months, and because somebody was telling me they thought that the earthquakes we've been having are, you know, atypical, that we're seeing a lot more Richter 6s and stuff like that. And I'll just read, you know, my data here off of this computer. I went back to 2016 in July, the end of July and into August, to see how many, you know, quakes occurred there. And then each month thereafter, each, you know, 30 days thereafter. And this month, you know, from September the 10th to October the 10th, the last 30 days, we've had 11 Richter 6 or better. Okay, the month before we had 12, month before that 10, month before that 10 again. The average seems to be about 11 Richter 6s, you know, through the last 14 months. And if you look at November to December of last year, there were 20 Richter 6s or better. And in the end of October to the end of November last year, there were 14. So last year we saw a lot more Richter 6 activity than this year. So don't be misled, you know, by the fact that we've had, 11 in the last 30 days. People are getting a bit excited about that. So I did a plot of that just to see if we need to worry about it. And at this point, I'm not. The small earthquakes in the United States around the Northwest, in that big chunk that always has an outline of quakes around it, that seems to be pretty busy at this time. And I've been seeing conflicting reports of a Richter 5 type earthquake just at the foot of the Juan de Fuca, but I've not been able to verify that on any U.S. or European websites. I think it might be just a bad seismometer reading somewhere. However, we are seeing more earthquakes, I think, in the United States in areas like Oklahoma and in Idaho. Now, on the map, it looks like it's a bunch of little dots over the top of each other, and unless you zoom in, you don't see how many there really are. And while we're on earthquakes, go to slide 43 and show images. Are you there yet?
Yeah.
Can you hear me? Right now. Yep, there we go.
Huh.
All right. Now, Kim, our earthquake monitor lady on the show, sent me notices all day today, have a look at this, have a look at this, as it was continuing. Now, there are about 150 quakes that have occurred over the last 3 days in an area you do not want to see them. Now, this is at La Palma Island in the Canaries, and that ridge coming from the volcanic cone up the top, coming down to the tip, that ridge is called the Cumbre de Vieja Volcanic Ridge. And it's a peculiar formation, as we've talked about before, in that you have like vertical crystallized wells, in essence, from magma formations in the past that held water, hold water. When earthquake activity cracks those, it's going to release large amounts of water underneath a bunch of overburdened sediment and dirt and stuff that's on top of the plain to the left of that ridge. Now, I'm not sure that I agree with where they say that tidal wave would hit when it comes, if it slides off into the sea. Excuse me. Some reports say that it'll hit up as high as North Carolina. I prefer the direction from what I can see. You can see the ocean bed there. The contour lines focus more south than straight across the United States. So I'm thinking it'll probably hit more like Florida, Puerto Rico, maybe up the coastline in northern Florida a bit, if it does happen, you know, reasonably soon. They've sent special teams, nine members, over to the Cumbre de Vieja to put in new monitoring equipment in the last 24 hours because they are understandably concerned about this. And, you know, I wouldn't like to be one of those nine guys sitting on the side of that that ridge on the left side of it, the west side of it.
No.
Talk about a ride. Wow. If that starts to go into the sea, you have a fast ride down the hill. Anyway, but they have put nine men and women over there to run the tests and to keep a close eye on it. They have no idea why it's happening, and I don't either, but as I say, you don't want to see earthquakes around those fragile vertical water barrels, in essence, formed out of crystallized, you know, magma formations in the past. They've stored up a lot of water and just natural processes, and cracking them certainly would lubricate a bunch of dirt stuff to slide off into the sea and create a tidal wave that could be hundreds of feet high when it hits the east coast of the United States. So that's earthquakes in La Palma.
Stan, before we switch gears here, I just wanted to bring attention to your photo or photos of the day on Stan Dale's website, standale.com. You click photo of the day there, it will pull up these images, California Dreamin' Turns California Hell. And this shows a number of pictures from the the wildfire devastation.
I think you were okay with that.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. And on Hagman Report, Stan, we showed a before and after picture of a neighborhood in Napa Valley, which had maybe 500 homes in this one area. A before and after picture where before it looked like a beautiful suburb and after everything was gone and charred. The death tolls continue to rise. People are missing in massive numbers. And this looks like a 15 plus dead, 200 missing. And they say expect the death toll to rise. And they're also saying that this is one of the worst wildfires in California history. And the suspicious nature of when a few of these fires started simultaneously, you know, all around 9 o'clock on Sunday evening, Saturday or Sunday evening, has been leaving many to ask, is arson involved? So John and I today did a little research trying to get a timeline of events of these fires, when they were started and where, but it led us to something else, that lots of people in California have been recently arrested, are still facing charges out on bail, or getting sentenced for doing these same things, trying to start fires, lighting incendiary devices in vegetation, attempting to start fires. This is a common practice in California, apparently, has become common, where people are intentionally trying to start these wildfires. And that's a kind of a side note, but I was just amazed doing the research. How many cases were in front of courts in different statuses in California just from this year?
Some for burn lines, but that's a different issue. Go on.
It'd be interesting to know how many of them are undocumented immigrants.
Yeah. That's one thing I couldn't find is a lot of the suspect information. Was the religious affiliation or the name even in some cases. But yeah, you know, we learned the first few pages of, you search California fire arson in 2017, and the first few pages are all basically court and newspaper records of people being arrested or being sought after, or being arraigned, being out on bail, being charged, sentenced. I mean, the whole gamut of the criminal process. And it just, me and John especially commented that, you know, wow, there's a lot of people trying to start fires this year. So, you know.
Yeah, go on.
Well, I just say, so we have to wonder, and keep our eye on the possibility that arson is involved in some of these fires that we see in California today.
You know, you were talking about those pictures you had early in the show, you know, the neighborhood before and after.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that too. Interesting point that some fellow down the street brought up was that if you look at it, the houses are burned totally to the ground. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, the fridges and other appliances and stuff are all, there's just nothing above, you know, like 6 inches. It's just rubble. Yet there are a number of trees lining the streets and stuff that didn't burn at all, which I suppose could be due to a hot Santa Ana type wind blowing in a certain direction, but it still seems a bit unusual that the fire just decimated, flattened all those houses in that neighborhood and left trees standing. If you look at that picture, can you see what I'm talking about up close to some of the dark shadows there on the street?
I'm looking for the article I posted on Hagman Report that has these pictures. Just give me a second. I will pull that up. So,
I mean, some trees did burn, but in that neighborhood, it seemed to be a peculiar burn pattern.
Okay, here I got it. And you said, let me bring the photo up here so I can navigate along with what you're saying. This article, folks, if you want to find it, go on HagmanReport.com. Before and after photos show devastation of fires raging through California wine country. It shows a huge populated rural area. And you said which trees? The
along the street side, I think there. I haven't got that picture in front of me, but I am trying to get it up here. Now, where did you say that was on your site?
It is.
Is it on the YouTube site or is it on your?
No, it's on Hagman Report. I can send you the link to this, Stan, if you want.
Right, it's now. HagmanReport.com, but the totality though, same thing, I guess.
Okay.
But
all right. Well, yeah. All right.
It's coming your way now, Stan.
All right. All right.
Yeah, Eric the Tech just said if you're on our site, you can just search fire, F-I-R-E. But nonetheless, yeah, interesting
anyway,
pattern.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's just it was the heat from that must have been very intense, melting metal and stuff like that. It's like a force-fed oven, you know, in a metal foundry, you know, you blow that hot air in there and it raises the temperature. But it was such a huge volume of fire with the hot, dry wind that it was really like a bellows blowing the heat through that neighborhood. Poor people, they just lost everything. I mean, there's nothing to go collect there.
Yeah. And it's, and also I was listening to Michael Savage and again, John Robertson, who has lived in California most of his life, talked about the places in Napa Valley where those fires were ongoing, and they basically described it as the breadbasket of the wine country, where not only, you know, the grapes are grown, but also many wineries have long-standing historic traditions there, and the how this was going to completely change the industry because these wineries are basically in the bowl, they call it, in that Napa Valley, and how the fires are just going to devour them, and it's going
to
be...
How many years is it going to take to regrow the vines, even if they've got cuttings to start it with?
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be, yeah, they got a long road ahead.
We get all of our wine from New Jersey grown.
No, we have great wineries here in PA and Western New York. There's a famous wineries right up,
yeah,
you know, 20 miles from us. It's a pretty
interesting
neat
climate.
Yeah.
Yeah, I still think it'll make some of the wines go up, but I'm sure that, that'll have to happen because of the scarcity. And stuff they had in the tanks would probably be gone now, too, as well. Hadn't even bottled it yet. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, along those lines, let me just get to the show images page here. Image 44, talking about, you know, produce and things. Bees, of course. We've been having a threat to the bee population for several years. And now then, they're finding out that worldwide, not just the United States, but honey from the bees, 75% of the hives they've tested over the entire planet, are containing pesticides in the honey. It's no wonder the bees were dying, and now that, of course, they're passing it on to us. There's an article there you can read about it, the tests they did, where they did them. Nature is gone askew. Poor little guys, poor us.
You were just talking about 44, right?
Yeah.
This is, Albert Einstein? Stan, you probably know this better than I do. Who talked about the population of the bees, and when the bee population, we see a big decrease in it, that it will affect the production of food through their pollinization process, and is a big red flag indicator to humanity that things are going very wrong with our ecosystem. Is that correct? Is that about right?
I don't know whether he said that, but I had heard that before. And, you might laugh at this, but we tried to grow a number of crops here in Holly's raised gardens at the house. And when the bees went scarce here, I was out there in our corn, the ones we planted corn in, with a little Q-tip. I was taking pollen, and I was pollinating every little corn stalk there by hand, playing the bee with it. And she's laughing at me, but she said, I loved it. I was fertilizing the corn plants anyway, doing the bees' job. And I guess if it comes to it, we'll have to do something like that as a race if the bee population just continues to drop like it has been.
And
it can be done. It can be done, but it's a big job.
The quote from Einstein, if the bee disappeared off the face of the earth, man would only have 4 years left to live.
Dang.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we could get some of these questionable migrants and give them some Q-tips and put them out in the fields and have them fertilize our corn and other crops for us. Do something productive.
Yeah, that's one way to do it. Or we can, continue to have the apiarist that handles the bees, get a lot more of those going, get, these huge bee colonies going to repopulate the bee population.
If you can find out what's killing them. I mean, is it pesticides?
Yeah.
Is it crossbreeding with other types of bees from South America? I mean, what's doing it? We know that the killer bees that migrated up here have been crossbreeding with the honeybees in North America, and the hybrids of that are not as lethal as the South American killer bees. But, they came up from South America, though, didn't they? They were African.
Killer bees, yeah.
Yeah.
They came up from Central and South America. And I remember they were making huge impacts down in Florida about 10 years ago, where they were becoming almost a pandemic down there, but it's kind of, from what I've seen, it's died off a little bit, or at least the coverage of that has died off.
Yeah, we saw a lot of bees here on our plants this year. I mean, Holly plants a lot of very colorful little flowers all over the gardens, which attracts the bees, and we had, we had bees all over the front garden by the pond and out in the vegetable gardens and stuff like that. I mean, we had record crops of a lot of that stuff. But we saw the bees, fertilizing them, so they were here. And it might just be that our place is more attractive visually than others, but we did have a good crop of bees this year.
Okay. Well, let's move forward here, Stan. You got a lot of stuff on Israel up on your show images page.
All right, let me go back up to that. Bits here and there. 53, 50, and 49. First of all, the Israeli military, knowing that they're so tiny population-wise and land area-wise, have almost since the inception in 1948 been preparing to fight larger enemies, more advanced technology and larger armies all around them. They are surrounded by about 35 Arab nations that won't have gone. Now, one of the articles I caught in the defense news was the Israeli military have been working on designing, it's a 6-inch shell, they call it 155mm, but it's a big bullet that comes out of a cannon. And they've been retrofitting it with a little fuse at the back that can actually guide that bullet, while it's in flight. And that little fuse box that they put on the back of heavy artillery like that can be migrated to all kinds of other heavy weapons, you know, artillery weapons like that. So that now then, that, you know, instead of being like in Battleship where you'd shoot a shell and you'd say, where did it land? The spotter say, well, it's off by about this far. Correct your thing by 2 degrees left and 1 degree up, and okay, fine. Now, with their controls, they can say, okay, where's it going? Okay, steer that bullet. There's where we're going to go, and drop it right on your target. Much more accurate artillery. And it just is another sign that the Israelis' R&D and their manufacturing processes for defending themselves are quite advanced. As of 2015, officially, I think the world authorities on this, on the nuclear weapons in Israel, said that the Israelis have at least 300 nuclear bombs. May not all be assembled, may be in readily assembled parts and places, but the materials are there, already made to put into bombs. So if people attack, if Arab nations attack Israel, which I think they will get a nuclear front. Even though the Israelis say they won't be the first one to use a nuke, when it comes, push comes to shove and they're being overrun, I'm sure that they'll wipe out some of the enemy army on the ground with nuclear weapons. They certainly have enough plutonium there now to make 300 weapons. And you can't blame them. I mean, everybody in the world seems to hate them. And they're doing their best to defend themselves. Now, in slide 50, to the right of that, I was impressed by the Israeli Air Force using printing technology. You know how you can reproduce things in 3D now then with these special kind of printers that will take a model of, say, a gun, and, they will electronically, digitally build up layers of this plastic that will make a gun to shoot, that could shoot a bullet. Or a bump stock, says Holly. But what we see here in the picture is the Israeli Air Force has developed the technology now then to rapidly reproduce, like in Star Trek, you put it into a food replicator. Well, this would be an equipment replicator where they have the small parts for aircraft that they need that wear out. If they're in a war situation where they can't get their normal supply from overseas or whoever does it for them, they can just make it, in a few hours versus a few weeks, which it would take to turn around from the normal manufacturing process. They just put it on a printer and dust off the edges of it and plug it into place and, Bob's your uncle, you've got a working plane.
Malfunctions happen during these type of 3D printing operations for supplies and weapons. You don't have more misfires for let's say a gun that was made from 3D printing. That doesn't seem to be the issue.
No, it's not the issue. And I use the gun as a common example, which we've heard of before. But what they're making is out of a different kind of material, and it serves a different function. For the most part, rather than being part of a gun cannon or anything like that, it's part of camshafts and other small things that break in an aircraft due to normal usage. I've seen, I use a company over in Europe. When I want to have something made in 3D, printed in 3D, they've now gone to making gold and I think they've got steel now. They plate these things, they build them up so that I've got components that are just like you get out of a machine shop. And it just comes off of a printer, and you can hold it. This is a very good technology. They've been investigating using that kind of technology for Mars and for the Moon to send up big 3D printing arms. Would layer and layer like this bricks and build habitable human houses up on the Moon or on Mars out of local components, maybe a bit of water and some other stuff, just some adhesives. And no one would have to be there. It would be done by remote, like with our Voyager and other things that go out and explore places. These things would land on these planets or the Moon and would be directed by us here on Earth to build habitats for us. And that's how much they've already started developing the technology. We are really just kind of a step away from even growing, steak protein in these things in layers, making artificial steaks by using 3D printing. I don't know that I'd find that to be the tastiest thing in life, but they are doing that.
Okay.
And up above, are you through with the 3D printing thing? Do you have a question?
Yeah.
No, I just want to say one thing. It's my understanding, and forgive me for the shameless self-promotion, but these were printed by a 3D printer. This actually, this sent in by a listener. This is a picture of, or a relief. I don't know what you would call it, of Joe and I. I don't know if you can see that or not. Anyway.
I'm just pulling it up now.
This is, King. King or dog, the iconic dog. There we go. That'll work. Eric is showing okay. That's actually a 3D printer.
Oh, on your microphone there?
Yeah. And it's coming up on the. Actually, Eric is putting it up on the video, but there's a large delay between the. Anyway, nonetheless.
Yeah, what a world of technological advances exactly. is allowing us to, you know, just bring the ingredients that are used to make a regular gun. You put them in the right spots, and those ingredients filter out to print a 3D gun.
Thanks, sir.
That functions properly, and now this application is being expanded out to a number of different things that make it a lot easier for military personnel not to have to lug all the stuff onto the battlefield. They can just create it while they're there, and it's no end in sight as to the capabilities and potential use for that 3D printer in war and in regular life.
Mm.
Well, they can grow prosthetic ears, real ears, actually, from the genetic material of a particular patient. And they can grow the ear on, say, a mouse back and then transplant it over onto the person, and his body will accept it, won't reject it. And these are just, you know, kind of early stage uses of 3D printing. In the long run, I think what we will see, certainly when the good Lord is here on the planet, but we will see tissue regeneration, bone, muscle, nerve. When you've lost a limb, that it will grow, be caused to grow back in and replace what you lost.
Mm-hmm.
Because the pattern for it, the electrical pattern for our limbs and our body is still there, even though the limb is gone. I mean, that ghost limb syndrome is a real thing. It's there's a field out there that the hand would grow into. So we're going to see some miraculous things sooner or later here that are like 3D printing, but using the body as the printer. It may take longer, but it will be, you know, a blessing to those that get the rebuilt things.
Amen to that. Yeah. Well, it's amazing. We covered a number of topics. I'm amazed every time you come on, and we after the show we talk, and there's rarely a time when we are not amazed by the range of topics that you cover. Go ahead, Stan.
Well, they're just things that catch our interest, you know, during the day and during the week. And one of the sad things in slide 51 is the Pentagon report on the state of our military. They're saying that we are showing signs of a total eroding of our military. If you read that article, you don't have to go through details of it here now, but the article does tell all the things they've noticed and, recorded in a special study about the weakness of our ground troops, our military, in addition to our Navy and stuff. They're just now taking one of those ships that was hit by another ship over in the Western Pacific there. They're going to heavy lift it, they say, into Japan for repairs there, which will take some time. And we've got two more of that class of ship that they're going to decommission by 2020. So they're only going to be good for another 2 years, and we need a budget for that. You don't see the budget for that. Anyway, the article does tell about these various things that are serious issues that the administration now and even the next one would be facing, and at a time when the world is gearing up for war with us. It's a very unhealthy position to be in. The last 8 years of the Obama administration totally crippled us. I think that he'll go down as the greatest traitor in American history.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, now, let's see here. Another interesting thing in the Middle East is we see something happening here. It's a master chess game. And we know that the Saudis have really been enemies of Israel forever, right? And the other 34 nations in the consortium with Saudi Arabia in the area really don't like Israel either. They want it to disappear. It's a thorn in their side. And yet, today, or in the last week, we see King Salman, Prince Salman's father, the king, goes over to Russia to meet with, you know, Putin and the staff there. It's kind of a formal howdy and shake and get to know you type thing. Now, that's the Russians, right? Now, the United States and Russia are at odds, and certainly at odds over the Syrian situation. And then you come back to Saudi Arabia at home at Riyadh, where King Salman's son, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, is making overtures to Israel for peace and all that kind of stuff. And let's go together and get rid of Iran. You know, we don't like them. But it's contrary to what they have been for 1,000 years or so in the Saudi arena for a couple thousand years. In that they are agreeing to be friends with Israel and yet preparing for an attack on Iran. And yet at the same time, Saudi Arabia is being friends with Russia, you know, which can supply the arms and technology they need to go in and to attack Israel. There's something rotten in Denmark, except it's rotten in Saudi Arabia at the moment, the Middle East. I just think we're going to see some sad times over there with like a cheating or a lying to Israel in a about face there instead of going into Iran and Syria that the Saudi forces and their consortium will go into Israel. It's getting closer and closer, and every time I see, you know, this kind of talk between, you know, King Salman and his son, at different odds of the spectrum, the political spectrum over there, it tells you that they're at their game again. They're playing this game of lie, cheat, and steal, but get your way. We've got to keep an eye on that Middle East situation. It's really getting serious.
Okay. Indeed. Indeed, yeah. And you know, your talk of a Islamic Antichrist, I'm really, boy, that's shaping up to be more and more. I'm just really interested in that, and I think that Islamic Antichrist, the case for that, it's interesting, especially when you dilute Islam, in the context of the Middle East, when you dilute Islam and you dilute all of the other religions or contaminate them, and then you know, this one world religion, but having it come from the lineage of a Muslim or the Islamic root, if you will. Very good work on that.
Well, just following the evidence, and certainly the Antichrist spoken of in the Bible will behead, you know, the Christians and Jews during the tribulation period, and that won't take the mark in worshiping. Now, that is an offshoot of the Islamic tradition of beheading the infidels or people who break the law of Muhammad. But that kind of thinking permeates not only the Middle East, but up into Turkey, beginning into Europe. And I think that you will see that, as it says in the Revelation of John, that the Antichrist, the first beast, will be wounded, will be taken out of power very shortly after he makes his move against Israel. But the second beast, the false prophet, they call him, he will institute this beheading, and he will do a lot of things that are in agreement with Islam and the punishment of people who don't follow Islam. So Turkey is Islamic, and Erdogan, who is the leader of Turkey, the president, and trying to be the absolute dictator if he can, really reveres their ancient hero of Solomon the Great. Again, the name Solomon is permeated in both areas, in Turkey and in Saudi Arabia. And Revelation 13, toward the end, we're talking about the here's wisdom, it's the number of the beast, the number of a man, the number is 666. That goes all the way back to King Solomon in the Old Testament. And so I'm sure that the name Solomon has something to do with the first and possibly the second beast of the Revelation of John. Again, I'm just like a detective and looking at current events and these clues that leap out when you read the good book. So I might be wrong, but That's what I see here at the moment. That's why my job is to keep an eye on the Middle East guys, I guess. And there's a European Antichrist they're looking for. There's another crowd looking for that. So between us, we're bound to come up with the right answer somewhere.
Well, Stan, you've been following the princes of Saudi Arabia for a long time. Even for, I'd say, the last 2 years, you've been on this show, probably longer. And you got it right with, oh, gosh, I can't think of his name now. You just said it a few minutes ago.
Oh, Mohammed bin Salman?
Yeah, yeah. And his, you know, rise to power. And now we're seeing him actually, you know, being ready to step in and take that power. And
well, he's...
Yeah, yeah, and you, I just want to say you called it. You had your eye on him as the primary guy for this role years ago, and now he's stepping into that role. And now there are questions that you have about, you know, going forward, how, if at all, does this play into prophecy, and what will become of it? And I just wanted to congratulate you on your great work, putting that together beforehand.
Well, so far it's important, I guess. We'll see how it plays out. But I know the news in the Middle East, the Arabic newspapers are saying that young Prince bin Salman, they're calling him MBS now, then just like I said to you a couple years ago, they just use his initials, MBS, which is very close to what Nostradamus called the Antichrist, the Mabus, M-A-B-U-S. Anyway, they're calling him the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia now, because he's back running the country while his dad is over making a kind of token visit to Russia as the head of the country. But the real, you know, grunt work is being done by his son back in Saudi Arabia while his dad is over there, you know, hobnobbing with the Russians. So they're saying that the change of power, the transfer of power, is no longer subtle. It's pretty obvious who's in charge there. There are a number of European and American businessmen that are putting investments into Mohammed bin Salman. You know, MBS is a West Coast development of the Red Sea development for a tourist mecca. And I think, what's his name, Virgin Airlines, whatever the guy that owns that is, he's putting like, Branson, he's putting like $50 million into that project now. So the young prince is attracting a lot of serious investment into his investment fund, he called it. And that's why he's selling off 5% of Aramco, the Arab American oil company, to raise $2 trillion to put into that fund to develop a number of things, including a global economic system which uses blockchains. It's a type of currency that's electronic, but say he's aiming it for companies so that if you sell a car to another company, then that transaction has your company name, how much, you know, the car was worth, it's, you know, how much you were paid for it, what clobber it had on, you know, what fancy tricks it had on it. And that digital record is kept on a global system that now tells that car was sold to this other company over here in Europe, and later on that car is then sold to Joe Bloggs over here. It's still on the world database in this blockchain, showing where it was originally made, all the original details of it, how it transferred to this other company and then to that individual. And this is just a simple example of what he's wanting to set up, of what MBS wants to set up in the world banking system. And he's getting a lot of support for it, because that means then that guns and all kinds of stuff that are sold will have an ownership record tracking it back to people that have to have a digital ID in the world system, or they can't buy or sell. And so he's doing things that sound an awful lot like what either the false prophet or the Antichrist are going to do.
And it's just that simple, really. I mean, it's just that, I don't want to say, well, it is that simple.
He's a bright fellow. I got to tell you, this MBS guy, he's a bright fellow. He's very learned in banking. In the west coast of the Red Sea, coast side of Saudi Arabia, there's a banking concern there. There's a Saudi bank that does world banking, fund transfers and all kinds of stuff. I'm just trying to remember the name of it there. It's near, it's west of Mecca, I think. Anyway, all these organizations are in place and getting strength from the money he's pulling in. And they're divesting themselves from dependence on the oil economy that Saudi Arabia's been on since, you know, the early 50s, which is a wise move because the oil that they've got, you know, the oil pressure. The wells is dropping, and the amount of oil they can pump is dropping. And the world is going to switch over to a new, cleaner type of fuel eventually. So he's way ahead of, you know, the old guard there in Saudi Arabia, and he has recently removed about 30 to 35 of the old guard in the leadership of the country and retired them. So it's a clean sweep. He's got the support of the young people there. He's just given women in Saudi Arabia the right to have driver's licenses, which makes him a hero for a lot of people and an enemy for a few others. But he's changing the times and the laws there in their country. Just amazing. He's fulfilling a lot of the little boxes that the Antichrist might do. But, again, I could be wrong.
Well, something definitely, as you've been saying for a long time, to keep our eye on, and you've been right so far about this man's rise to power and influence. So we will continue to keep our eye on that stand, and we will continue also to rely on you to bring us updates and reports as to the changes you're seeing as we move forward from here with Saudi Arabia.
One last thing on that. You know, I talked about finding Atlantis, and that was Saudi Arabia was a major part of Atlantis. When I worked for Dr. Teller's group down in Australia years ago, when we were developing anti-gravity and a lot of other technologies in conjunction with beings that weren't from around here. You know, they were either fallen ones or you know, I guess I'd just call them fallen ones. And they had a base in Riyadh, about 120 miles out of town, down the Jabal Tuwaik mountain range. Just kind of, here's Riyadh, then you go down the Jabal Tuwaik, and about 120 miles down here was where they had this base with technology that they were developing. And it's odd that this would happen, because Atlantis was, the legend of it was that fallen ones mated with our women in that area and produced hybrids, and that's what caused God to make the flood and destroy all the hybrid animals and beings that these fallen ones had created. And now they're back there in the same place again with the technology, and they have a base there that I know they've got, which could very well be supporting young MBS in his march to, you know, to try to take over Israel, to conquer Israel and the area, and to be a superpower in the area. So it's all coming back to, you know, what caused the flood in that area.
Yeah, and I love your, when you go back and from finding the different asteroid impacts in Google Earth, to your searches from the Garden of Eden to, you know, looking at where Noah's Ark could be and all these other ones. This is when we talk about Indiana Jones. These are Indiana Jones type investigations, only on just a different, in a different way. You know, he's not out in the field looking for the Holy Grail. He is using the technology of today, looking for ways to explain, you know, what has happened from, you know, the expansion of the Earth to all the different things in between, with the natural disasters, the dinosaurs, and everything else. And I love when you find something, Stan, from the Garden of Eden to Atlantis, again, to so much of what you've done, your book, The Cosmic Conspiracy, one of the later editions. I really love that and how you put together the earthquake figures there. But you've done a great job of putting these together, and not only for our audience, but on the presentations you do when you speak. And it's always fascinating to see, you know, to be able to cooperate and look for the mysteries of the Bible. And I can't imagine the feeling of finding something, you know, written in the Bible thousands of years ago that you're able to confirm is actually what you thought it was.
You know, I'm working on another project kind of in the back burner, but with another biblical scholar here in Colorado. In fact, we're having a meeting here shortly in a few days about the path of the Exodus. We have made some major inroads in finding proving what the Genesis account said about the Exodus, where it occurred, how long it took to get from point A to point B, and the actual mountain of Sinai, God's mountain. It's not where they think it in the Sinai Peninsula, it's definitely over in southern Jordan. And all these things that we're finding, they're absolutely solid proof that there were a large group of people there with livestock, and they passed through that area just like the Exodus account said. And as I say, some of the things that we're finding are rather extraordinary as far as like what caused when Israel was just escaping Egypt crossing the Reed Sea, what caused that easterly wind all night and made the dry land appear. And it was a typhoon type thing, or like a hurricane, except it was stationary, not moving. It was created to be right over the top of them. And how it, the high speed winds around the outside of it forced the Egyptians to stay on their side outside of this spinning, you know, vortex. And Israel was in the middle with warm, moist air coming straight down on top of them. They couldn't get their weapons across either to get to the Egyptians. Neither one of them could fight with each other because of this high speed wall of air circulating around like that, and the pressure down like that was pushing all the water away to, you know, make, give them dry land by morning to march on over to the other side. And you'll see that that area is near the Suez Canal at the start of it there, and it's kind of circular, very shallow, and you can see how it wouldn't take much pressure at all to just blow the water out of the way. It's not like a 200-foot drop or anything. It's like, you know, 15, 20 feet in some places. Push it out of the way and let them get across, and then flash back as soon as this thing moved across to the Sinai side of it. It would have just wiped them out. I don't know if we're going to find any of the chariots and things like that they've been talking about they'd like to see, but I'm pretty sure we found the area.
Very interesting. And a natural, I don't want to say excuse, but a natural reason. It's interesting how God uses weather and weather events for things like that.
They call that area the Sea of Reeds as well. And in the Greek, because Plato, you know, his grandfather, I think it was Solon, went over to talk with the priests of Egypt at Sais and got a lot of information on the ancient history of the area. But the Greeks named a particular reed, it's a tall reed, and it's hollow inside and tubular. The class of it is called the Typhonus, like typhoon, for that area. It's grown in that area where we were talking about that they probably crossed. So all these little clues do add up.
Man, that's amazing. Stan, you did this again, took us to the end of the program. It covered a lot of ground in this segment.
Well, wow. next week, Lord willing, we'll do it again.
Indeed.
Yes, we will. Thank you so much, Stan, and thank Holly for us, for allowing you to spend this time with us. And
right. Holly says you're welcome. She's waving.
Well, we're waving back, and you take care, Stan, and we will talk with you next Tuesday.
All right.
All righty.
God
night,
bless.
Night, guys.
Good night.
God bless you.
Good night. Folks, thank you so much for tuning into the program. And please, listen, tune in to the Doug Hagman Radio Show, Doug Hagman Investigative Hour, 9 to 10 Eastern Time. That's on the Global Star and BTR. And just go to HagmanReport.com. And then 2 to 3 for John and Joe Show. And, of course, our flagship show, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, bringing you all the news from a Christian conservative perspective. May God bless each and every one of you.
Till tomorrow, stay safe. God bless. Have a great night.